Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Five Star App Meditation Studio and Muse, the brain sensing headband that gives you feedback on your meditation practice. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host, Muse founder, Ariel Garten. This month, we're focusing on happiness. What is it? How do you invite more of it into your life? You will be surprised to learn that it's not exactly what you think. Join us each week this month as we explore this topic together. If you have feedback, questions, ideas, or stories to share about happiness, email us at founders@meditationstudioapp.com. Now, here's Ariel to kick off our month of happiness.
There are two ways to live our life. One way to live our life is as if nothing is a miracle. The other way to live our life is as if everything is a miracle.
Welcome to Untangle. Over the next four episodes, we're going to focus on the subject of happiness. What happiness is, how it's generated in the brain, how to find it, and how to find more of it in your own life. For today, in this first look at happiness, we have a happiness expert, Tal Ben-Shahar. Tal is an author and lecturer in positive psychology and organizational design. He actually taught what some say is the most popular course in Harvard's history, positive psychology, teaching stressed out, driven students some of the forgotten tools to succeed in life. He's also the co-founder of the Happiness Learning Academy and has written multiple books on the subjects with titles like Shortcuts to Happiness. Welcome, Tal. Excited to have you here to learn how we can all be happy.
Thank you, Ariel. Great to be here.
It is a joy and a pleasure to have you. So let's start at the very beginning. What is happiness?
There are many definitions to happiness. And, you know, many people argue that it's a little bit like beauty. You know it when you see it, or in the case of happiness, you know it when you experience it. The definition that I work with and that I found useful, both in terms of research as well as application, is that happiness is about whole person well-being. In other words, it's about well-being of an individual on the spiritual level, the physical level, the intellectual cognitive level, the interpersonal relational level, and finally, the emotional level. An easy way to remember this, the spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional, is that it spells the acronym SPIRE.
You just put an A in the front of it, we would have aspire to happiness, the thing we all aspire to.
Yes, indeed we do. You know, it's Aristotle talked about it, the Dalai Lama talked about it more recently, that happiness is our highest end, you know, the objective, the goal, the aspiration that we all have.
Is happiness really the highest goal or the biggest end?
It is by default, meaning by our nature. Now, does it mean that, do I think that it's the most important? I think it is very important. Mm-hmm. However, one could argue, you know, being a good person is more important for happiness. Being moral is more important. Fortunately, they coincide. They're not in opposition. So there's actually research, a lot of research, showing that when we act morally, when we do good things, we also contribute to our own happiness. So it's a win-win. We can be good and happy at the same time.
Oh yeah, there are all those studies that show that if you have $5 and you choose to give it to somebody else, that makes you happier than keeping the $5 for yourself. So there's sort of this socially inborn process that encourages us to engage with one another and be good with one another and rewards us with happiness through it.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is a wonderful part of our nature, that doing good for others does also good for ourselves. So that, it's a wonderful thing, whether it's God created or through evolution, it's a wonderful instinct that we have to help others, to contribute to others, to make others' world better. And by extension, we help ourselves as well.
So you referenced that happiness, you know, something that we seek by our nature. Can you unpack that a little bit further? It's a really cool concept.
You know, on the very fundamental level, you know, babies try to avoid pain and they seek pleasure. not just babies, adults as well. Only adults have a more sophisticated and complex perspective on happiness than just merely pleasure. So for instance, we look for a sense of meaning and purpose in life. And from the age of 10, 11, 12, children talk about the importance of finding meaning or doing something that matters to them. So we want to do things that matter to us, and we want to matter. And this is an instinct. Unfortunately, this instinct is sometimes foiled, but it is an instinct that exists, and the right kind of education will build on that. We'll build on our desire to do good. We'll build on our desire to look for and find meaning in life.
But how is that? So how is the search for meaning related to the desire for happiness?
Okay, so, you know, there's very interesting two lines of research which may seem contradictory, which may seem in opposition. On the one hand, we have research showing that pursuing happiness is good for us. There's a lot of research showing that if people become happier, even by a little bit, they become more productive and more creative. Their relationships improve significantly. They even become physically healthier, so their immune system strengthens. So beyond the feeling that we get from being happy, the good feeling, there are also benefits to it. So happiness is good for us. On the other hand, there's also research showing that people who value happiness greatly, who wake up in the morning and say, I want to be happy or happier, actually end up being less happy, more susceptible to loneliness and even depression. So there's a problem, because on the one hand, we're told happiness is good for you. On the other hand, we're told, but you know, wait a minute, don't pursue it, because it's actually not good for you to value it and to look for it. What do we do about this? The answer is that we can pursue happiness indirectly. Now, the analogy that I give is the following. Imagine sunlight. You're looking at the sun directly. It hurts. It's not fun. It's not enjoyable. So what do? You look at sunlight indirectly, how you break sunlight down to its elements. And what are the elements? The colors of the rainbow. So you break the sun using a prism, and then you can enjoy the product, indirectly enjoying the sunlight. In the same way with happiness, pursuing happiness directly doesn't help, actually is more likely to hurt us. So we break down happiness into its elements. These are the spire components. So if I wake up in the morning and say, I want to be happier, you know, pursuing happiness, not good. But if I wake up in the morning and say, I'm looking for a sense of meaning, what provides me meaning? What are the things that are important to me? Or if I wake up in the morning and say, how can I help others? How can I contribute to others' well-being? Or I wake up and I say, you know, I want to become fitter, healthier, or meditate more, be more present. All these things are ways of indirectly pursuing happiness. It's about pursuing the rainbow, metaphorically speaking, and reaching higher and higher levels of well-being. Indirect pursuit of happiness. That is the answer to the paradox that on the one hand, happiness is good, and on the other hand, pursuing it directly may hurt.
That is fascinating. That is the hidden irony of happiness.
Yeah, very much so. And unfortunately, most people are not aware of this research. And you know, if I think about my role in the field of happiness studies, it's to make more people more aware of the research out there, because there are some great ideas, tips, tools, techniques that we can use, or different ways of understanding happiness that we can apply to our lives and become happier. And again, becoming happier is good for us. It's good for society.
So I guess in some ways that explains why for many people, happiness is so elusive, that the moment you start wanting it, it starts to hurt.
Yeah, exactly right. So it explains another phenomenon, which is how is it that today we have so many more books on happiness? We have so much more knowledge about it, and we have more awareness. And yet levels of happiness are not going up. On the contrary, depression is going up, anxiety is going up. Not just because of this, but this is one of the reasons.
Can you talk a little bit about the global levels of happiness?
Sure. Well, again, there's a lot of research on the macro level happiness. For example, there's research on the happiest countries, the happiest nations in the world. For example, among the happiest countries in the world are countries like Colombia and Costa Rica and Denmark and Norway and Israel and Australia. And the question is, why these countries and not others? You know, why is the US, for example, not very high on the happiness rankings, or, you know, why is Germany and England even lower than the US, or, you know, the Asian miracles, Singapore, South Korea, why are they unhappy on average? And when researchers looked at the happiest countries in the world, they were able to identify one key characteristic, one distinguishing factor, and that was relationships. Exactly. Relationships, the emphasis on social interactions. So I'll just give you an example. Denmark, a few times, ranked number one on the happiness rankings. 93% of Danes are members of social clubs. Now, they can be members of their church or yacht club or mahjong club. It really doesn't matter. But they're active members of social clubs. And that makes a difference. That actually does make them significantly happier. Or a place like Colombia, with its fair share of challenges, certainly in the past, has been among the happiest countries in the world. Why? Because there's a real focus there on friendship and on family. Now, the interesting thing about relationships, it doesn't matter what kind of relationships, in the sense that they can be romantic relationships, and it can be a friendship, it could be family relationships, whatever it is. But people who have, who enjoy intimate connections, not perfect connections, but intimate connections with other people.
So that suggests that one of the best ways to become happy, indirectly, of course, is to strengthen the connection with the people around you.
Big time. And when we talk about connections, we're talking about real connections. So unfortunately, 1,000 friends on social media are no substitute for that one BFF, best friend forever. We need the face-to-face interactions.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great. And this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, help.com/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Do you really think that people in Denmark, for example, have stronger and better social connections than people in Canada, for example? You know, somebody in Canada, I sit here, I have a family, I love them, I have coworkers, I love them, I have friends, I love them. Yes, I would rank myself a very happy person, but I don't know that I'm so out of the norm relative to just having, you know, normal people in my life.
So here is the thing. Of course, you know, in Denmark, there are people who are miserable, and in Canada, there are people who are ecstatic. We're talking about national averages here. And when they looked at national averages, what they found consistently was that the best predictor of national level happiness is how much the culture as a whole emphasizes real relations, social support.
It's fascinating, and it points to the opportunities not just for individuals to create deeper relationships in their lives, but also for, you know, municipalities and government on a larger level to look at how it creates social connection and community, and therefore, you know, increases the happiness of their people.
Absolutely. You know, first of all, I think society at large or nations should begin to look at happiness. You know, so every country in the world measures gross national products, GNP, or gross domestic product, GDP, but very few countries actually measure happiness. So, you know, Bhutan started it, and now few countries are looking into it, you know, measuring gross national happiness, GNH. But why not measure it? Not instead of, in addition to, especially given the fact that we know that if you increase levels of happiness, people will become more creative, more innovative, more engaged in work at home. So there are other benefits to increasing happiness beyond just the feeling itself or the experience itself.
Can we look at Bhutan for a moment? Do you know much about what they've been doing there and what's been successful?
Yes, so Bhutan is a very interesting case study because they were the first country to actually explicitly talk about gross national happiness. And other countries are taking notes. The thing is that not everything in Bhutan is replicable to, you know, Canada, US, or Europe, or China for that matter. It is a deeply religious country. It's a Buddhist country. They have very strong traditions and some, you know, amazing traditions, but not ones that we can actually implement in the West. The other interesting thing is also to see what Bhutan is going through as it modernizes. So one of my students, for example, did research in Bhutan. She traveled there and studied the culture. And she was fortunate or unfortunate, it depends from which perspective you look at it, to be there when television was introduced.
Hmm.
What she found was that there was a drop in levels of well-being, eating disorders that didn't exist there prior suddenly emerged, more unhealthy forms of social comparison. So happiness levels actually went down. And this is a very important lesson for them, obviously, but also for us here in the West when it comes to technology in general. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm all for technology. The fact that we're having this conversation is thanks to technology. You know, I teach online classes. I just met my best friend from when we were 12 years old. Our parents moved countries and we met thanks to social media. So, I think it's wonderful and I'm all for it. The thing is that we need to set boundaries, limits. In other words, we need to do it in moderation.
I would agree. As somebody who has a young child and is watching the relationship to technology grow and develop in ways that bring up questions that I didn't have to deal with as a child and my parents didn't have to deal with and my parents' parents didn't have to deal with.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So the idea of social media also brings up questions of self-esteem. Self-esteem being something that's obviously very closely tied to happiness. And the saddest stat that I've ever heard is that apparently 85% of the world has low self-esteem. We have narratives about ourselves that, you know, do not align with reality, and we just feel a little bit crappy about ourselves every day as a result of it. What in your research and your, you know, engagements in the subject have you seen there, and what do you think are some solutions?
The reasons for the low self-esteem that we see in our culture are varied. On the one hand, there is something which is deeply inherent in our culture that has nothing to do with modernity. And that is our perception of the self versus the other. Specifically, when the Dalai Lama came to the West for the first time, he was really taken aback by the fact that people have low self-esteem. And he attributes it to our understanding of compassion. So when we talk about compassion, what do we mean? We mean, well, let's have compassion towards other people, you know, to the less fortunate, to a person we just met, whomever it is. Compassion in Tibetan thought is first and foremost about compassion to the self and then compassion towards others. Specifically, the word sewe, which in Tibetan would be translated to compassion, means compassion towards the self and compassion towards others. Now, why is that important? You see, in the West, and you look at this, this is very deeply rooted in our DNA as a culture. We separate between self and other. So for example, let's look at a dictionary definition or a thesaurus when it comes to the word selfish. And selfish, look it up in thesaurus, it's equated to evil, bad, self-centered, immoral, and so on. You look at selfless, what would be the synonyms for that? Good, moral,
virtuous,
kind,
yes.
Generous, and so on. So there's a real distinction between selfish and selfless. One is bad, the other is good. Now, a person who literally drinks this understanding with their mother's milk, they take it from generation to generation. How are they going to grow up? They're going to grow up and say, well, if I'm being selfish, for example, if I pursue my own happiness, that makes me a bad person. So it pits the self against itself. And now, I spoke about this earlier, it's human nature, it's instinctive to pursue happiness. So basically, I'm fighting my instinct from, almost the day I'm born. of course I'll have low self-esteem. On the other hand, what's the alternative model? The alternative model, okay, yeah, pursue happiness. And that means you're not being kind, generous, because you're not selfless, for sure. So I think we need a new cultural definition of what it means to be a good person. And if I had to synthesize between the selfish inclination and what we associate with a selfless inclination, such as helping others and being generous, instead of selfish or selfless, I would use the word self-full, self-full. To me, that captures the way we want to be in the world with ourselves and with others. It's bringing the two worlds together, the world of pursuing personal happiness, personal growth, and pursuing a generous, kind, benevolent life. They're two sides of the same coin. They're both instinctive, and we should cultivate and strengthen the two instincts, the two sides of that coin of the self.
That's a really amazing insight. You know, the distinction that you colored between selfless being virtuous and, you know, selfish being, you know, abhorrent in some way, really is a kind of Judeo-Christian lens of seeing it, where, you know, you're not supposed to have pride, you're supposed to be humble.
You know, I think that this distinction or this break between self and other happened later on as religion evolved. Why? Look at what is the foundation? The Jewish religion, the Christian religion, also of Confucianism in the East, the foundation is the Golden Rule. What does the Golden Rule tell us? Some variation on love your neighbor as you love yourself. The implicit understanding here is that self-love is the foundation of loving others. That is the standard that we use. Love your neighbor as, in other words, to the same degree, in the same way that you love yourself. It doesn't say love your neighbor and discard yourself. Whereas in modern understanding, we have this breach, this distinction between self and others. For example, the word altruism, which so many people celebrate, the altruism means literally negation of the self. That's not the Golden Rule. That's taking and it's a subversive understanding, a false understanding of the Golden Rule. And I would argue of human nature and of morality. I mean, look at many of the societies that were built on altruism. Look at what happened in the 20th century with communism. Communism essentially fought against human nature, against our inclination to also, not only, but also think about ourselves and look at the results.
That's fascinating. You started to tell us that there's going to be a second point on self-esteem that you wanted to make.
Yeah, the second point has to do with modernity and the way we live our lives today. One of the most important sources of self-esteem, of healthy self-esteem, are relationships. And not just relationships where we're told, oh, you're amazing, you're great. No, but intimate relationships where we open up, where we form strong connections, strong bonds. And today, the relationships are not as strong, not as intimate as they used to be in the past. Now, why are they not? For various reasons. One reason is because people spend more and more time on social media. Eric Kleinberg, who's a professor at New York University, did research showing that the more time we spend on social media, the lonelier we become, the lonelier we feel. And of course, loneliness is both a product of and a cause of self-esteem, product of low self-esteem, and it hurts our self-esteem. So spending more time with people face-to-face is important. Another element which indirectly affects our self-esteem.
I'd love to just comment on that for 1 second. So that's really fascinating. So I imagine part of the reason that having intimate connections boosts our self-esteem is because in an intimate connection, somebody is able to see the parts of you that you do not necessarily accept, and they're still there with you and they still love you. So through intimate connection, by being, you know, vulnerable, whether you choose to or not, and inadvertently or advertently showing somebody the negative sides of yourself and still having them there with you, it shows you don't need to be shameful about you. You are still worthy, you are still loved regardless of your perceived imperfections. And so social media not just creates a disconnect by having a lack of close social connection. Social media is also a place where you're not allowed, or most people feel they're not allowed to show their imperfections. They must be hidden further and therefore become more shameful and thus more erosive to the self-esteem.
That's exactly right. I mean, what happens on social media? You know, we go online and we see everyone having an amazing time, an amazing family, amazing work, and just being, you know, happy all the time. And we go on there and we say to ourselves, wow, everyone is happy except for me. But we don't want to be the the only party poopers here. We don't want to appear like there's something wrong with us when everyone else is right. So we continue and we put up also those pictures and those posts where everything seems great with us. And what we're doing, we're contributing to what I've come to call the great deception, which contributes to the great depression.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
You know, I have several friends who are very open about the challenges that they're having in their life, and they post regularly on social media. Some might call it oversharing, but they post about their challenges as they're having them the moment, greater existential challenges. They're not negative people, but they're just willing to be honest about what's going on. Some would say possibly to a fault. Has there been any research whether that kind of behavior actually leads to healthier psychological outcomes?
In general, sharing and being authentic, and the key here is on authenticity, is good for us. The question, and I'm not familiar with research on this part, but it would be a very important question to ask, is, you know, do we get the same benefit from opening up to 1,000 people online as we do to, you know, our BFF?
So given that social media is here and most people, particularly those who are listening, who probably at some point discovered a podcast on social media and then started listening to it. Considering most people are stuck in this era of social media, do you have any recommendations as to how to healthily engage in a way that protects our self-esteem and our happiness?
Sure. Again, going back to ancient wisdom, Aristotle talked about this 2,500 years ago. He said, the measure of virtue is moderation. And being on social media is fantastic. It's important. You know, my wife has a phrase which I love, where she talks about using the rectangle to exit the rectangle, meaning using the rectangle, which is your smartphone or your computer, which is rectangular, so that you can get out of the rectangle, so that you can really meet people, you know, to make up with friends using your whatever app you use. So use it rather than be used by it. If we're used by it, that by definition means we're addicted.
It's a very, very good insight. Do you have any insights for how people would best manage themselves while scrolling through an Instagram screen, for example?
Yes. Again, put the time limit. You know, if let's say you decide, okay, so I have half an hour to look through it now, put a timer. And the timer will tell you when to stop. Also have accountability buddies. You know, go work on it with your partner or friend. And if you deviate from what you decide on, that's okay. Just share it. You know, no one's perfect. Also have days that are technology free. So there's research in organizations by the likes of Leslie Perlow from Harvard Business School and others showing that when we take time off, free ourselves from technology, it increases our actually productivity, creativity, happiness levels, or job satisfaction at work. So have days when you don't use it, or have hours during the day when you're technology free. Now, these are times that I've come to call our islands of sanity. And we all need these islands of sanity, whether it's a day long or an hour here and there.
So we've gone through all sorts of fascinating research on happiness. We've talked about the preconditions that allow happiness to flourish. We've talked about the value of social connection. Can we now get really practical on things people can do in their life to increase their happiness without, ironically, trying to get happier while doing it?
Yeah, so there are quite a few indirect ways of pursuing happiness. And, you know, I spoke earlier about the definition of happiness as spire, spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional well-being. So let me go over each one of the spire elements and introduce one, perhaps, intervention that is relatively straightforward to implement. So beginning with spiritual well-being. Spiritual well-being is about finding a sense of meaning. So asking, you know, what are the things that can increase a sense of meaning? And spirituality is also about being present, being in the here and now. So I know you're somewhat familiar with the muse. So using the muse or just sitting down and meditating actually increases our quota of spiritual well-being, which is a very important element of a happy life. You know, 10 minutes of meditation, even 5 minutes of meditation a day can go a long way in increasing happiness. Then we have physical well-being. Regular physical exercise, one of the best ways to increase happiness levels. 30 minutes of aerobic exercise 3 times a week actually has the same impact on our overall happiness as our most powerful psychiatric medication. In fact, it works in the same way. It releases norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, you know, the feel-good chemicals in our brains. So regular physical exercise. Now, does this mean we just throw away psychiatric medication? Of course not. You know, there are people whose lives were saved, are being saved by medication. But physical exercise is certainly a very important psychological intervention. Then there is intellectual well-being. You know that research just came out showing that curiosity actually leads to a stronger immune system. It actually leads to a longer life. So longevity is impacted by learning, by curiosity. So, you know, learning new things, whether it's watching a TED lecture, you know, here, this is one of the great benefits of technology, where we have access to so much fascinating information, you know, listening on a regular basis to podcasts, reading, going to museums and studying works of art, or going out for a walk in nature and really becoming absorbed in nature. That also cultivates our intellectual muscles, cognitive muscles, so to speak. So that's intellectual well-being. Relational well-being, I spoke about a lot, spending quality time with people we care about and who care about us, and spending that quality time when we're just with them, technology off, distractions off, and so forth. And then finally, emotional well-being. And emotional well-being is about, first of all, giving ourselves space to experience painful emotions, not fighting them, not rejecting them, giving ourselves the permission to be human first. And then second, it's about expressing gratitude. So people who express gratitude on a regular basis, you know, keeping a gratitude journal, as Oprah told us to do so many years ago, that turns out to be very beneficial for physical as well as mental health.
Excellent. So to recap those, we had spiritual well-being, which can include activities like meditation and probably also prayer. You would certainly in that category. We have exercise. 30 minutes of exercise may be just as good as a psychopharmaceutical. Fascinating tip. Next time you're not motivated to go to the gym, just think about how happy you'll be when you walk out, but don't try to be happy while doing it. That's a joke. Next, we had curiosity. The old phrase, curiosity kills the cat. It turns out Tal is telling us is absolutely not true. Curiosity lengthens the life of that cat, or at least will lengthen the life of the human who engages in intellectual endeavors and curiosities. And then the last one we had was emotional well-being. And in emotional well-being, we contain concepts like being sure that we are fully accepting and experiencing of our emotional world, not pushing them away, being alive emotional creatures, though hopefully not becoming overwhelmed by the negative sides of our emotion, but being able to ride through them just by experiencing them, letting them come and letting them go. And we also have practices like gratitude that can increase your happiness. And I'm going to be willing to bet. There's also some evidence there that demonstrates it too will lead to a longer life. And then we had relationships, which we've spoken much about, connection to one another. So you've given us 5 tips to potentially improve our happiness indirectly. I'm curious to know a little bit more about you personally and what are some of the most valuable ways you've found to improve your happiness?
Yeah, so, you know, for me, a lot of the things that I do, I guess all of the things that I do are also things that I teach about. So, for instance, for me, it's been very important to set boundaries, whether it's boundaries on technology or boundaries on work, so that when I'm with my family, I'm with my family. So that when I work, I work. Also, I exercise regularly. I do meditate regularly, and I'm also a yoga instructor. So I do a fair amount of yoga. And this is very important, I also give myself the permission to be human. You know, especially at the beginning when I started off in this field, my goal was to be happy all the time, or the implicit expectation that people, or not so implicit, sometimes explicit expectation that people have of me is, oh, you're the happiness expert, you need to be happy all the time. You know, I'm not. I have my off days and I have my difficulties and hardships. And, you know, I always say there are only 2 kinds of people who do not experience painful emotions such as sadness or anger or envy or frustration or sad or anxiety. 2 kinds of people, psychopaths and dead people. And I'm very fortunate to be neither a psychopath nor dead. So it's, you know, applying the material. This is why I love this field so much. Yes, it has it's an academic field and there's a lot of fascinating research, but first and foremost, it's an applied field.
I'm thinking about some of the things that I do to be happy, and probably one of the definitely greatest drivers in happiness in my life is this implicit understanding that I have inside of myself that I love life. I love the act of living in all of its weirdness and frustration. And when something gets really hard or bad, I can stand back and say, whoa, this is alive. Isn't living strange? Isn't this funny? Isn't this weird? Isn't this amazing that I get to experience this? And that can be so hard when you're at the depths of it.
I know, but you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking of a quote that's attributed to Einstein. I don't know if he actually said it, but it's a beautiful quote nevertheless. And that is that there are 2 ways to live our life. One way to live our life is as if nothing is a miracle. The other way to live our life is as if everything is a miracle. And if you think about it and you really take time to observe, to be present to reality, you know, everything is a miracle. I mean, the fact that, you know, we hear each other is a miracle. The fact that, you know, I'm looking outside my window and there's a tree, that's a miracle. And even when we go through difficult times, it's still possible to, you know, to take that, you know, step back, or it's rather a step forward, leaning into life, that can remind us that everything really is a miracle and everything is a wonder.
So the irony at the end of our whole conversation is that the route to be happiness is to not worry about trying to be happy.
The irony is that we worry about it and we accept the fact that we worry about it and that it's okay. You know, don't worry, be happy, that song. You know, it's difficult not to worry. You know, worry and be happy. Embrace it all.
Well, after our conversation, I feel happier, or maybe more specifically, less pressure to be happy.
Oh, thank you, Ariel, and thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you. Well, thank you for taking us on this awesome journey through the research on happiness and through your own personal experience. It's been an honor, a pleasure, very eye-opening and inspiring. That was Tal Ben-Shahar. He's the author of the books Happier and Shortcuts to Happiness. He's also the co-founder of the Happiness Learning Academy, which provides certificates and master's program in happiness studies. And he's clearly a wealth of research and information on the subject. You can find out more at Tal Ben-Shahar, that's TalBenShahar.com. And if you're curious about Muse, which Tal mentioned, Muse is a tool that helps you meditate. It gives you real-time feedback on your brain and body during meditation. You can find out more at choosemuse.com. Muse can help you start, maintain, or enhance your existing meditation practice. If you're curious about picking one up, you can use the discount code UNTANGLE15. Patricia will be back next week with more on happiness. Till then, be happy. Don't worry about being happy. Don't worry, be happy. Be happy because we don't need to worry. Life is good with Much love and sparkling neurons. Till next week.